Good afternoon. We are back. As you may notice, there has been a panel change. The panel now is, to my right, Justice Bill Meyer. To my left, Justice Bonnie Sutterth. And I'm still Leanne Dofino. And understand that both sides in our second case are ready to proceed. So if you'll call the case, we'll get started. You go by Tom or Thomas?
Tom, but officially Thomas.
Okay, Tom, you ready?
I'm ready, Your Honor. May it please the court, Tom Brandt for appellant, Fort Worth Independent School District. This court should reverse the judgment of the trial court and render a judgment in favor of Fort Worth ISD based on the uncontroverted evidence in the record that establishes the school district's affirmative defense. This case is actually a very simple case, despite a lengthy record and trial and a tortured history. It's a very simple case. It's about a school district exercising its statutory right to save tax dollars. That's it. It's as simple as that. Fort Worth ISD exercised its statutory option, its statutory right, to save money, to save tax dollars. There has been, though, a very strong and concerted effort to complicate this case, to obfuscate the very simple, straightforward, and dispositive issue that I've alerted you to, that is, the exercise of the statutory option. The way that the complication has come in is by Mr. Palazzolo and his lawyers, with the help of the trial court, have done their best to obscure the simple fact.
Let's get one thing straight. We're in Fort Worth now. All the lawyers, the judges, are colleagues.
Yes.
We do not engage in personal attacks. And you're welcome to argue the record. You're welcome to argue the law. But don't engage in personal attacks, please.
I apologize, Your Honor, if you took that as a personal attack. What I meant by that was that the overruling of our position by the trial court assisted the presentation of the case as it was presented, which was different than the case as pled. That was my point, not to attack any colleague.
Thank you.
The case that was actually pled was a case about a decision made by Fort Worth ISD in 2012. If you look at the live pleading, which is the first amended petition, the plaintiff talks about his termination in 2012. And it stands to reason why he would talk about that, because the decisions or actions taken in 2010, the statute of limitations has long since passed with respect to all of those. But instead, the plaintiff focused on the 2010 events to distract the jury from the very simple, straightforward, dispositive issue of the 2012 termination. The case that was actually pled was 2012. The case that was presented dealt with the 2010 issues.
Well, primarily. Aren't the two situations related?
They are related, and I have a handout that I have prepared for the court to kind of bring that into more stark relief.
So you kind of have to talk about the 2010 events in order to explain the 2012 event.
Procedurally, yes. Historically, yes. But not with respect to the issues that are before this court, the legal issues that we have before the court. For example, in January of 2014, almost two years ago to the day, this court ruled in favor of Fort Worth ISD in the first Palazzolo appeal, having to do with 2010 issues. Those issues, though, were brought over our objection, were brought up before the jury, and so we ended up having to deal with dead issues that were paraded before the court that had nothing to do with the decision itself. What they did was there was a procedure, there was a history that brought the Fort Worth ISD to the period in which they had the option to take the statutory option. And in the handout that I've provided to the court, you'll see on the left side of the page is background only. That's the 2010 termination. That termination, as you can see, was a vote in October of 2010. A majority of the board voted to terminate Mr. Palazzolo's employment for good cause. And it was, that vote occurred 2 weeks after this court decided, and this is a quote from this court's decision, Palazzolo actively circumvented Fort Worth ISD's efforts to redress the complaint of conduct by advising the board that he had no dispute with his transfer and appraisal report. In other words, Palazzolo lied directly to the board about saying everything in the 2010 situation is resolved, I'm good with it. Then 2 weeks later, he files suit against them. That was the subject of the first appeal. That's where Fort Worth ISD prevailed on that before this court. It was after, then he proceeded through a TEA proceeding. That TEA proceeding was a very lengthy proceeding, reportedly the longest TEA proceeding in the history of the state of Texas, very expensive. That's what brought the option to the Fort Worth Independent School District Board, because at the conclusion of that lengthy hearing, the Texas commissioner said you have two options. You can redo that long, expensive hearing, you can do all that, or you can simply exercise your statutory option, pay him a year's salary, front pay, and then, of course, the back pay as well. So that was the clearest option, the cheapest option, and what you see in there is that although the first vote in 2010 was a 6-3 vote, and there were three board members who voted against it, and Dr. Sutherland was one, and Carlos Vasquez was another. Those two voted, actually Dr. Sutherland moved to approve the statutory option. Carlos Vasquez seconded that motion, and then it was a unanimous vote to exercise the statutory option to stop the bleeding. This was an expensive litigation that was going on in the administrative process, and they wanted to stop the bleeding. Now, and this was a unanimous decision. So then we go to when we clearly see how the 2010 issues are background. They're not parts of this appeal because jurisdictionally they couldn't be. There's been no initiation or exhaustion of remedies for that whistleblower case in the 2010. This court's already found that in the previous appeal. But in the 2012 termination, it had to do with that decision. So we look at it. It gives us four issues to deal with. There are many other issues that we deal with in the brief, but the four issues I'd like to address are, is it an affirmative defense? Did we preserve our error? Was it harmful error? And then what should happen, a rendering or a remand? The first issue, is it an affirmative defense? I think that's a very simple issue. The Texas legislature calls it an affirmative defense. Then this Court of Appeals has not only called it an affirmative defense, but has actually applied it as an affirmative defense. The fact that the Houston Court of Appeals has gotten it wrong shouldn't persuade this court to follow that wrong lead. It's very simple. It's an affirmative defense. Now, did we preserve that issue? Yes, we did. We pled the affirmative defense. We submitted it in the pretrial submissions. We submitted the jury issue on it, and it was not included, and we objected. What you have in response by the plaintiff is a form over substance argument that has been clearly and repeatedly rejected by the Texas Supreme Court in the Alaniz case and the, I believe it was Payne case, but there's the Thoda case as well. A series of three different cases have addressed this issue and saying we're not going to be hyper-technical on these issues. If you put in front of the judge and you present it and you object, then you have preserved. So we did preserve that issue. Then we go down to the third issue, is did the trial court commit harmful error in failing to present our affirmative defense to the jury? And I think the answer is clearly yes. We needed, the judge clearly refused to submit the question to the jury. We asked for it, we submitted it, we objected, and it's clear on the record there. We needed that affirmative defense to go towards to the jury. We needed that. And what we look at, when you look at the record, is you'll see that the question, the trial court decision to refuse us the jury issue on that, meant that the judge did not allow the jury to apply the evidence to our affirmative defense. If the trial court had allowed the jury to apply the evidence to the affirmative defense, then the only decision that would have been supported by the evidence would have been a decision in favor of Fort Worth ISD, because the only evidence on the issue were two pieces of evidence. One document, the other was testimony. The one document was the minutes from the Fort Worth board meeting. Those minutes clearly reflect that Dr. Sutherland moved for admission, moved for the motion, and it was seconded, and it was applied unanimously. It was approved unanimously. And it specifically references the TEA decision. It specifically references then the statutory option. That was the only evidence. The plaintiff spent so much time talking about the events of 2010 that they completely neglected to put on any evidence except for Dr. Sutherland and that piece of paper, the minutes from the board meeting. The evidence from Dr. Sutherland, she was called, she's a sitting board member of Fort Worth ISD, she was called by the plaintiffs to testify. And she testified that although she voted against, in 2010, she thought that was a bad decision, that was her opinion, that it was a bad decision in 2010, but she thought that the 2012 decision had no retaliation attached to it whatsoever, and that she was for it, and that she had no retaliatory intent against Mr. Palazzolo whatsoever. So it was that uncontroverted evidence was it. That was the only evidence about the intent or purpose of that decision to exercise the statutory option. So the trial court clearly committed an error which was harmful to Fort Worth ISD, because we were not able to get that question before the jury. The trial court's decision also was not simply an abuse of discretion. It was that, but it was also an error of law, as a matter of law, because what the trial court did was interpreted incorrectly the affirmative defense, essentially as an inferential rebuttal, and that's not what it is. It is an affirmative defense. Had the trial court interpreted it properly as an affirmative defense instead of an inferential rebuttal, and had it allowed the jury to rule on that question, then the only decision which would have been supported by the evidence would be a decision in favor of Fort Worth ISD. So clearly the error was harmful to Fort Worth ISD. That leaves us with the fourth and final issue that I would like to address, and that is whether this court should reverse and render or reverse and remand. I submit to you that the court should reverse and render, because there is no fact question here. The evidence that you have before you is the evidence that was presented in a trial in which the plaintiff had the full and fair opportunity to present any evidence he wanted to present. The only evidence he presented on the 2012 decision was the testimony of Dr. Sutherland and the minutes from the board meeting. Those support a render in favor of the district. There are practical reasons as well to have a render instead of a remand. The history of this case demonstrates that Mr. Palazzolo is an extremely litigious person. He has sued us four times. He has now filed his third appeal. We started a trial once, settled. He fired his lawyer. The settlement was scuttled. We tried it again. He had a TEA hearing that was reportedly the longest hearing in the state of Texas history, and he is currently before this court in a related appeal challenging the jurisdiction of this very court to hear this very appeal right now. If you reverse and remand, then we will undoubtedly be back in front of you again, and that would be just a waste of everyone's time.
Mr. Bryant?
Yes, sir. Yes.
At the time of the 2012 vote, unanimous vote, and that was a vote to elect to follow the statutory remedy of 21.304F.
Yes.
Did the Fort Worth Independent School District actually make payment Mr. Palazzolo for his back lost wages and the 1 year front fee?
Absolutely, yes.
And he took the money and put it in the bank?
Yes, and he got paid from 2010 to 2013 without ever doing a lick of work for Fort Worth ISD. My time is up, but I do have some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul?
May it please the court. I am Paul Wineski here, representing Joseph Palazzolo today, and seems like I was just here.
You're always welcome, Mr. Wineski.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. There was so much news material offered by Mr. Brandt that I'm not quite sure where to begin. However, I would submit that the school district focused an awful lot of its evidence and efforts in the trial court on the 2010 termination and why they thought they had good cause for it. So to suggest now that that is all irrelevant is somewhat inconsistent. Let me point out, as mentioned by Mr. Brandt, there is another case pending in this court concerning these same parties. They're reversed. It's Palazzolo versus Fort Worth ISD Board of Trustees, and that is 02-15-00302 civil. And the court's decision in that case could, in fact, be dispositive of this case for the reasons stated. And I don't want to argue that case here, but I did want to make the panel aware that there is another case. It has not been briefed yet. The appellant's brief is due in February, so it'll be a few months before it's ripe for decision. But along those same lines, I took the liberty of counting in the school district's brief the number of times that the word uncontroverted was used, and I came up with 33 instances. I also counted the number of times the word conclusive was used, and there were 24 instances. And I will submit to you, when you read the record in this case of this six-day, hotly contested jury trial with witnesses testifying to dramatically different versions of the same events, you will come away with the conclusion that there's very little about this case that is actually uncontroverted or conclusively proven. I want to object to the handout as an additional brief that counsel has not sought nor received leave of this court to file and is therefore improper at this point. Okay, the Whistleblower Act is remedial in nature, and it is to be construed liberally to achieve its purposes, which are to protect public employees from retaliation from reporting illegal conduct, and to secure lawful conduct by those who direct or control public bodies. And I'm going to ask this court, in its consideration of this case, to keep that overriding purpose in mind and try to look at the issues in this case through that lens, because I do believe that will be helpful to the court in coming to its conclusions. The Texas Supreme Court has made clear its preference for broad form jury submissions. And one of the reasons given for that preference is so that to avoid the opportunity for the jury to come back with conflicting answers to different questions, thereby requiring appeals and retrials and waste of judicial resources. If the trial court had taken the school district's suggestion in this case and submitted the statutory affirmative defense as a separate question, that is precisely what could have happened. The jury could have easily been confused and or come up with conflicting answers to those two questions, which would have thrown out the trial and required a retrial at the very least. The question here tracked the pattern jury charge on the issue. The commentary to that pattern jury charge does mention that, yes, after a certain date, it can be an affirmative defense as stated in the statute. But that commentary is silent on whether that defense is to be submitted as a separate jury question or as an instruction. And there is no suggested question or instruction included in the pattern jury charges. That statutory affirmative defense, even though it's called an affirmative defense, is in fact, under the rulings of this court, the Texas Supreme Court, and many other appellate courts in this state, an inferential rebuttal issue. Why? Because it seeks to disprove an essential element of the plaintiff's cause of action, i.e. the causation element in this case. This court has recognized very clearly the fundamental difference between affirmative defenses and inferential rebuttal issues. Repeatedly throughout its history, I've cited in my surreply brief some instances both in the past and as recently as last year when the court repeated, if the defense tends to negate an element of the plaintiff's cause of action, it's an inferential rebuttal defense, and those cannot be submitted under Rule 277 as a question. Now, the district might have been entitled to submit that defense as an instruction because they did plead it and they came up with evidence they claim supports it. But they never requested an instruction. They never submitted in substantially correct form a written suggested jury instruction to go with question number one, which would have been the proper way to submit it. They didn't object to the non-inclusion of an instruction. They insisted then, and they insist to this day, that they are entitled to a separate jury question on that issue. And that is simply not permissible under the law of this state as announced by this court and others. With all due respect to Justice Meyer, the legislature does not always know precisely what it is doing. And
only after I left.
That is true, Your Honor. This was 10 years after you left that this provision was inserted. And I suspect you've observed, as I have, that the percentage of members of the legislature who are practicing litigation attorneys has decreased consistently over that period of time.
I agree with that, too.
So, the education code provision that has been discussed as an independent ground for termination in the year 2012 is not a ground for termination. It's a method of termination. They could have stuck with their original desire to terminate Mr. Palazzolo as they did in 2010 and gone through another TEA hearing, and according to them, under their evidence, they would have won that hearing and that would have been it. They made a choice. I will not argue that choice saved some taxpayer dollars in the short run. But as we've argued in both of our briefs, the fact that Mr. Palazzolo is not contending that the school district didn't comply with that education code provision, just like Mr. Watson wasn't contending in the Houston ISD case that the ISD wasn't complying with that contractual provision. In both cases, the plaintiffs were saying, look, this is how they fired me. What I'm complaining about is why they fired me. And the reason they fired me was because I filed a report in good faith of illegal actions. Let me point out to the court, one of the few facts in this case that is undisputed is that on the day that Mr. Palazzolo walked into the school district offices and filed his reports and the reports that had been given to him by others, his personnel file was spotless. His evaluations were all excellent. There were no complaints, no letters of concern, no reprimands, nothing. That filing of that report triggered the school district's investigation, which ultimately resulted in his termination. And that, I believe, is all that's required. I still fail to see the did cause equals rendition, probably did cause equals remand in any Texas case set out if the school district would have this court accept it, and I certainly don't accept it. I want to talk just for a moment about the lost employee benefits. The district has challenged the factual sufficiency of the evidence to support those, and my response is, number one, according to the Supreme Court, if you're going to look at one of these insufficiency cases, first you look at the jury charge itself. And the jury charge itself asks the jury to find lost employee benefits other than loss of earnings, period. Not during the period of suspension or termination, not lost employee benefits in the past, just lost employee benefits, period. I'm afraid the jury may have suffered from something that we may have all suffered from when we were given the task in first grade, and we were given a sheet of paper with 20 different items on it that we were supposed to complete. And they start off with punch three holes at the top and draw three squares on the side and whatever. And you get down to item 20, the last on the list, and it says, do nothing but sign this paper and turn it in. Do not complete any of the above tasks. The lesson we were to learn from that is read everything before doing anything. And it was a good lesson, but I forget it routinely, and I believe that's what the jury did in working through the jury charge. When they came to item B that said lost employee benefits, not restricted to past or future, they calculated what they thought was lost employee benefits. And I have some calculations in my appellee's brief, which I won't go into here, but which I believe shows that, the figure that they came up with falls within the range of evidence at the trial. And as the court knows, just because you can't tell from the record exactly how the jury came up with its damage calculations, that is not fatal as long as it falls within the range of evidence submitted at trial. And my conclusion on that is strengthened by the fact that if you look at our expert's report, the amounts that he has listed for future lost salary by themselves are both higher than the amount that the jury actually awarded, which under the wording of the charge was supposed to be for both future lost wages and benefits. So that reinforces my conclusion that the jury just lumped all the benefits in item B and had nothing left for item C.
Mr. Wineski?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your briefing as well as the briefing of the appellant, there are actually came from the expert's testimony that the dollar amounts were based on, in one category, Mr. Palazzolo staying at the same position, an assistant principal.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there was another set of damages that were our testimony about damages that related to his having been promoted to principal.
Correct.
Why was there any question about whether he just was going to stay where he was or whether he was going to be promoted?
Well, Your Honor, the testimony at trial was that Mr. Palazzolo wanted to work for at least the next 10 years, if not 13. And nothing much stays the same over a 10 or 13-year period. Mr. Palazzolo expected that there was at least a good possibility that he could be promoted and therefore wanted to provide the jury with the information so that it could make a determination based on whether he stayed as an assistant principal, got promoted to a full principal. There were no adjustments made for potential future salary increases over a 10 to 13-year period, which you can pretty much assume there would have been at least some given the bureaucratic nature.
Well, the reason I asked the question is I asked earlier if Mr. Palazzolo was paid the back wages and the 1 year's front pay and accepted it. And if the factual circumstances were that that's what had happened to him, how likely was it that he's going to be promoted to principal in the Fort Worth Independent School District?
Well, he was looking to be reinstated. Whether he would have been promoted or not is somewhat up in the air. But I think probably Mr. Palazzolo simply wanted to provide the jury with as much information as possible to make an informed decision.
Thank you, sir.
On to the statutory cap. This, I believe, is a question of first impression in the state of Texas as to whether that statutory cap language applies to only future pecuniary losses or for future losses of every category included in the list. The school district devotes many pages of its briefing in trying to fit this language into the doctrine of last antecedent or some other statutory construction doctrines, and it really tortures the language of the statutory cap provision as well as those canons of construction. We believe that the proper canon of construction to construe this language is what's called the series qualifier canon, as called by Justice Scalia and Brian Garner in their book On Reading Law, which, to simplify it, simply says, if you have an adjective at the beginning of a string of nouns, that adjective applies to each noun in that list unless another adjective or something else jumps in there to knock it off track. So future applies to not only pecuniary losses, but also to emotional pain, suffering, inconvenience, mental anguish, loss of enjoyment of life, and other non-pecuniary losses. Those are all future damages, and the jury awarded zero for those. There would have been no reason for the pattern jury charge committee to include two separate questions including all of those elements of damages if the word future only modified pecuniary losses. Then the two questions would have been pecuniary losses in the future, answer, and then past pecuniary losses and past and future emotional pain, suffering, mental anguish, et cetera, everything else. So the pattern jury charge committee obviously didn't construe it the way the school district wants you to construe it. We would also say that the liberal construction doctrine encourages this construction, given that no cap on past damages makes it a more expensive proposition to violate the law, and one of the reasons for the liberal construction is to discourage retaliation and violations of the law. We also believe that public policy favors a cap on future but not past damages, because future damages by their nature tend to be somewhat more speculative. In conclusion, we believe the trial court got it right. We believe the jury got it right. This was a six-day, hard-fought jury trial by good lawyers on both sides, and the jury rendered a proper verdict. The trial court rendered a proper judgment, and we ask this court today to affirm that judgment in all respects.
Didn't mention anything about attorney's fees, Mr. Wineski.
I'll be happy to, if you like.
Talking about the attorney's fees point, dealing with the $243,000 awarded to a six-year lawyer and a less than one-year lawyer for 6 months' worth of work, in which the reported time frames were often right at 20 hours a day.
Your Honor, they testified that they worked 20 hours a day on some of those days, and sometimes 22 hours a day. I've found no legal authority that says that one has to be an expert in employment law in order to command a $350 an hour fee to represent a plaintiff in an employment law case. I would suggest to the court that the results that were obtained by those lawyers, a $2.1 million verdict before you add the attorney's fees in Wise County, Texas, of all places, I think that demonstrates their ability and their experience goes far beyond what the school district would suggest. I myself parachuted into this case with only 2 months to go before the hard briefing deadline, and I had to bring myself up to speed. And I will guarantee you, I did bill Mr. Palazzolo for, and he did pay, the time that I took to get up to speed on this case, even though he had a previous lawyer who may or may not have been up to speed on it before she got out of it. So the arguments that we've made in our brief, Your Honor, is that those fees were justified and fully documented, even though they might not be as clearly documented as you might like because of the way they coded in their paralegal time. I won't get down in those weeds, but I did in my appellant's brief, or my appellee's brief, and I invite you to review that.
I did read it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tom?
Yes. It is an affirmative defense. Make no mistake about it. In the question you asked Justice Sutterth earlier, you asked me about this background, and isn't it connected? Let's just assume that it is connected in more than some just historical way. First of all, it's unconnected because jurisdictionally it's beyond the scope of any judgment to reach back to. But let's just to say it's connected. Then you can see how starkly real the affirmative defense is, because let's just say you ignore the jurisdictional problems and you reach back and you say, this wouldn't have happened if they hadn't terminated him in 2010. We wouldn't have reached over here to 2012 termination. That's when you see the affirmative defense that this court has recognized in the Steele case comes into effect. At that point, then, the burden that we have on the affirmative defense is to plead it and prove it, and to say that we would have taken this action even though there was a cause that would have been a retaliatory cause. That's the nature of the affirmative defense.
Well, I think they're saying that you might have been entitled to some discussion of this in the charge. The question is whether or not you're entitled to a question or an instruction.
Yes.
And you're saying it's an affirmative defense simply because the statute calls it that. But he is looking, your opponent is looking at it as, what does it effectively do? Does it say, yes, I did it, but here's my defense, which is typically an affirmative defense? Or does it say, Well, I get off because I get off of the charge because it's logically inconsistent for both to be true.
Right. You've got it. You've hit it on the nail on the head. Affirmative defense is yes, but. Yes, I ran over you, but it's been 2 years. You didn't file it. Okay? This is like that. It's saying yes, but. Yes, if you can prove the prima facie case, you've proven your case, and then we can bring up this affirmative defense that says, but.
Yes, but I would have done it anyway.
Yes,
for
we would have done it for another reason. That's why they call it an affirmative defense in the statute. That's why this court has called it an affirmative defense, because to rule
about
it the other way.
What about that language in Steele that says that it tends to negate the plaintiff's proof? That is classic inferential rebuttal definition.
Right, but that's not that language is not the controlling language of the decision. That is language in there, but it's not that issue wasn't so starkly before this court at that time. What you have, if you really start thinking about this inferential rebuttal issue, you have some language in a statute that is meaningless. It has just been erased by this argument of inferential rebuttal. Because you would then say, you have to prove your prima facie case. You have to prove the elements of your case to win, plaintiff. But there's an affirmative defense over here that says if you don't prove your affirmative case, you don't win. That's a nonsense statement of the law. And we can't read the legislature's words as nonsense. We have to read them as something that has meaning. If we read it the way is suggested by the plaintiff, it erases it as an affirmative defense. And since it says affirmative defense, why should we do violence to the legislature's words and call it an inferential rebuttal and say you have to live with an instruction? That's what the plaintiffs want to say. That's not what the statute says. That's not what the legislature says. And that's not what this court has said. Only one court in Houston, which doesn't control, has said that. No other court has gone along with that kind of reasoning. The fact of the matter is, it is an affirmative defense. We did plead it. We did preserve it. It was harmful. It should be reversed.
Who bears the burden of proving that there was another reason for the termination?
It's our affirmative defense, so we bear that burden. And the evidence that was presented at trial was sufficient to sustain that burden, which was the minutes from the board meeting and the testimony from Dr. Sutherland, who said, yes, although I voted against terminating him in 2010, I didn't agree with that decision, I wholeheartedly moved for this one in 2012 because I saw what kind of a mess and expensive and time-consuming and litigation I wanted to put an end to it. The legislature gave the school district a way to get out of endless litigation.
And
that's why
agree,
I'm suggesting.
And you agree that the burden is on you to prove the other reason?
Yes, it is because it's our affirmative defense, so we have to prove that, and we did. Dr. Sutherland was called. I cross-examined her. I elicited the testimony, and I proved through her own mouth the affirmative defense that we are entitled to receive. That's why if we go back, we're just going to be spending a lot of money, a lot of time on a losing proposition that was fairly and fully litigated on that point. There's no reason to do anything but to render.
Sure.
And that's my time is up.
I'm through.
Mr. Brand, I know your time is up, but I want to ask you in regards the statutory defense and the question as to whether other reasons for taking the action of termination have to be exclusive of the reporting of the events, or whether the language that's in the Steele case even talks about you can have these other reasons and you can take action for the other reasons, even though there might be a reason that could be retaliatory.
That's right. You've got it right there. If the plaintiff proves that a cause of the termination was a retaliatory motive, then they have proven a cause, they have proven their case. Then the affirmative defense says, even with that cause existing, the school district can prove it still would have acted in 2012 to do what it did, despite the fact that 2 years earlier or more, something happened back here, that we come to this decision point now and we say, this is it. So you don't have to, we did not have to prove that the 2012 decision was immaculate and unadulterated with any spot of history that occurred. It brought us to that point. What we did have to show is that we would have done this regardless of any reporting way back several years ago. Did that answer your question?
Yes, and also the briefing that's been done seems to want to focus specifically on whether there's a requirement in order to use the affirmative defense that it be, according to the plaintiff, exclusive of other reasons for termination, as opposed to just a additional reason for termination when the proof is submitted and an action taken could have been in relation to other deficiencies in performance unrelated to the retaliation and the reporting.
Yes. If an employee reports and later you find out they stole from you, you can terminate them for that reason that they stole from you, even if you were going to terminate them because they reported.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we do appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. There are no additional cases set for oral submission today, so you're free to go about your business, and there is no case for you to sit in here. This court will be adjourned.